Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the investigation into the backgrounds of the San Bernardino terrorists, in particular Tashfeen Malik, and examine her time in her native Pakistan with Pakistan's former ambassador to the United States, Hussein Haqqani. He joins us to discuss the role of Saudi Wahhabism in her radicalization, along with the possibility that she received military training in one of the many terrorist camps in Pakistan that have yet to be shut down. Then we will discuss President Obama's address to the nation on dealing with terrorism and the self-declared Islamic State, and speak with Arun Kundnani, a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, who also teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. He is the author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, and we will discuss the gulf between the major role that politics play in the radicalization of young Muslims who join Daesh compared to the minor role of religion, which usually gets most of the attribution and emphasis. Then finally, we'll examine the Justice Department's launch of a patent and practice investigation into the Chicago Police Department following the release of a video that showed a Chicago policeman shooting 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times. Craig Futterman, a professor of law at the University of Chicago and founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project of the Mandel Legal Aid Clinic, joins us. He played a key role in getting the video released, and we will discuss the DOJ investigation and the latest release of a video of a Chicago police shooting. And joining us now is Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, who is a senior fellow and director of the South and Central Asia program at the Hudson Institute. He served as Pakistan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2011 and is widely credited with managing a difficult partnership during a critical phase in the global war on terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani.
It's a pleasure being here, Ian.
And obviously there's a lot of investigations underway now. There's certainly questions about how, when, and why were the two young Muslims out here in Southern California in San Bernardino responsible for the massacre of 14 people and the wounding of 21 others. And to some extent, both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are being looked at in terms of Tashfeen Malik's background. What are the questions about this Al-Huda Center in Multan that she went to school there, studied there? It's a religious school, but she did it concurrently when she was also studying at a nearby university for a pharmacy degree. So how would you consider that school in terms of the words like radicalization that are being bandied about now?
But let me just say that radicalization actually varies from individual to individual. So the same person can go to the same kind of religious school and turn out to be a very conservative person, but not necessarily a violent person. That doesn't mean that there is no relationship between a hardline view on religion and radicalization. It sometimes serves as a stepping stone. So first you start believing that religion has a very narrow interpretation. This is what God wants me to do. Then you sometimes start thinking God wants me to do it in a violent way. And we have seen that phenomenon all over. I mean, we've seen people, for example, in the United States who oppose abortion. Not all of them want to bomb abortion clinics, but you can see certain people wanting to do it. That said, I think what we are seeing is a global phenomenon and a global problem. The Muslim world has been in decline for a long time. Muslim leaders, instead of facing that, talking to their people and saying, you know, guys, we've been left behind by the West because we are behind in technology, we are behind in literacy, we are behind in knowledge, we are not very productive. If our countries were not blessed with oil, we wouldn't have much of an economy. What many leaders, and religious leaders included, have resorted to is a kind of a culture of victimization and victimhood. We are victims of colonialism, which of course was a bad thing, but it's not the reason why people are not literate, say, for example, in Egypt or in Pakistan. So governments, radical Islamic clerics, and then everybody who feeds this narrative of victimhood instead of making people think that they need to do something, just make them hate somebody or the other. So, for example, if you see Sayyid Farooq, the person who was married to Tashfeen Malik, he has a track record of strong anti-Semitic views. And that anti-Semitism was not because of his love for the Palestinians or because of the Arab-Israeli conflict, but it's just an inherent view that, you know, these are that somehow my religion tells me to hate people of another faith or of another history. That is the real reason why we see much more violence among Muslims than we see in other communities. And instead of saying that this is directly related to piety or religiosity, we must understand that it has to do with the specific ideas that take root in the minds of some of the people who consider it their religious duty to be violent.
But in trying to sort of pass out the difference, Ambassador Haqqani, between conservative and radical, I suppose in a way you could say, well, the Wahhabis are conservative and Daesh, the Islamic State, is radical. And
there are a lot of things in between. So, for example, there's Wahhabi conservatism, then there is Wahhabi conservatism, which is harsh with other Muslims, but not necessarily at war with anybody. Then there are those who become violent. We've already seen Al-Qaeda in the past, the Taliban, and now we are seeing Daesh. And Daesh is the worst form so far. But I am afraid that it may not be the last. We may see another version that would be even worse than them, because very frankly, what they are trying to do is they are trying to, quote-unquote, purify the ranks of the Muslims through violence. They kill more Muslims than they kill non-Muslims, and at the same time trying to change the whole world through these random acts of violence, which is not going to be fruitful. I mean, they will kill a few people here, a few people there, but 1.4 billion Muslims will still continue to follow the various strands of Islam. There are at least 70 recorded denominations in Islam. They can't impose their only version as the one religion, and then certainly they're not going to change the world or the order of the world with these acts of terrorism. So they are destined to fail and lose, except they will create a lot of mayhem in between and cause a lot of pain to a lot of us.
But there does seem a pattern amongst the Wahhabis and the Salafists in targeting the Sufis and the more liberal, I guess, for the want of a better description, versions of Islam. It used to be Mecca and Medina had a lot of pluralism, but since the Wahhabis have taken over, that pluralism has gone away. And my sense is, from talking to a lot of Muslim scholars, is that's what Islam desperately needs, is more pluralism, and the heart of it in Saudi Arabia has to be changed.
Absolutely. Look, pluralism emerged over centuries. And unfortunately, in the last two centuries, Wahhabism has sought to destroy it by arguing that there is only one type of Islam that is tolerable, and they have it. That is a problem that happens almost in other religions also, when somebody says, I am going... So, for example, you know, in Christian history, Oliver Cromwell and his view that, you know, he will use the power of the state or of the kingdom to purify Christendom. The good news there was he didn't succeed in the long term, and pluralism came to Europe. Unfortunately, the Muslim world is not doing too well in terms of embracing pluralism. Many of our dictators looked the other way when Wahhabism and extremist ideology was spreading, because they thought that was a good way to counter whoever else they thought was their political rival. So, for example, a lot of people thought it was a good counterweight to communism. Well, guess what? Communism is gone, but the extremism is there, and it's now coming at us with a vengeance.
So let's insert these two characters back into the discussion that we've been having, Ambassador, in terms of Tafsin Malik and her husband, Syed Farouk. So what's your sense of the journey, both in terms of Pakistan and they met during the Hajj in Saudi Arabia? There's some suggestions that there may have been a setup to get her over here into the United States. There's still a lot more to be learned about that. But in the context of our conversation about Wahhabism, is there a role there, do you think?
Ian, you said it. We have a lot more to learn about them, but certain things are very clear. One thing is that as far as Syed Farouk is concerned, he wanted to be, quote-unquote, a pious Muslim. He also was affected by sort of religio-political ideas, including a lot of anti-Semitism and a desire to rid the world of the domination of the evil West. So he had those ideas in his head. He didn't. Such people these days, for example, he apparently was also on some Muslim matchmaking sites. And in his matchmaking profile, he said he wanted a pious woman who was committed to Islam, etc., etc. So he is already a conservative Muslim, and then he runs into somebody. We don't know whether it was just Ashwin who came first, or whether he had run into such people before, who said, "You really want to be pious? Well, all this prayer and abstinence is not the way forward. You just do a big act of jihad and go straight to heaven." And Tashfeen has a similar journey somewhere. And she's already hating Shias. She's hating Sufi Muslims already. And she's thinking, these people, they are not pure Muslims. I'm looking for purer Islam. And she runs into somebody who also persuades her that she needs to go beyond this and do some great act for Islam. And then we don't know whether they came together and she made him more radical, or he made her more radical, or whether somebody else already knew that both of them have been radicalized, or one has been, got her here into the United States and made them do this heinous act of terrorism, which really advances no big goal for anybody except causing misery to some people. But the way they think, they're also trailblazers. So there are other people out there who might think the same way and say, I want to do it too. Now, internet has become another way of radicalizing a lot of people. We are noticing people who are extremely religiously conservative, but then not religiously conservative only in a personal sense. That I think the world can handle. That would be part of pluralism, right? That some people are slightly more religiously conservative, some are less. These are people who become evangelical in the sense that they have to persuade others, they have to somehow change the world, they have to bring everybody else into the same mind set that they have. And there are people lurking around, preying on these people, saying, "Have you read such and such verse in the Quran? Have you read this hadith? Do you know that such and such religious scholar, usually the Wahhabi scholars that they cite, or Ibn Taymiyyah, who is even pre-Wahhabi, some of the more extreme scholars, who did not have many supporters up until a few decades ago, despite being entrenched in the heartland of Saudi Arabia and the Arabian Peninsula, that is the true Islam." And then that appeals to people, and then they act on it. And that's exactly what we see happening to this couple.
Well, Ambassador Haqqani, my understanding from law enforcement sources out here in San Bernardino is that the woman was the one that was shooting at the police. He was driving the SUV, and according to these sources, she was an awfully good shot. So is there a possibility that she had some military training somewhere?
Absolutely. She definitely could have had. Among the problems, look, everybody's talking about Saudi Arabia being the home of Wahhabism. If Saudi Arabia is Wahhabism central, Pakistan, unfortunately, a country that I come from, is jihad central. Now, Pakistan was the center for jihad against the Soviet Union. At that time, even the United States was supporting that because everybody thought, we are training people to fight the communists. Communism went, the jihadis entrenched themselves in Pakistan. Pakistan's military and intelligence services continued to nurture jihadis because they thought that was their ticket to expanding Pakistani influence into Afghanistan, a relatively poor country trying to control another poor country, and then also for settling their scores with India in Kashmir. So Pakistan has had training camps for jihadis for decades now, going back all the way to 1979-80. And some of those camps have been shut down, but some of those camps have just relocated, and people who've been trained, first the people who were trained to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan ended up fighting on behalf of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and now they have trained other people, and it is perfectly possible that Tashfeen was one of those who was trained in some terrorist jihadi camp in Pakistan.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador Haqqani, the president tried to calm the nation, and of course he's under a lot of pressure from the right with people like Donald Trump running on rather Islamophobic expressions and tapping into the sort of darker side, if you will, obviously we need at this moment the better angels of our nature to emerge, but that's not necessarily going to happen. What was your sense of his appeal, and what do you think can be done to bridge this growing gap? Because obviously when these Muslim leaders have to parade in front of the cameras and defensively say Islam is a religion of peace, that can't go on forever. There has to be a breakthrough, I think, made, don't you think?
Absolutely. But first of all, let me just say that this is not new. Soon after 1945, when Americans realized that there was such a thing as communism that was a threat, there were people like Joe McCarthy who did succeed for a little while in scaring America into believing that there are Reds under the bed, into thinking that every American Hollywood star or producer or director or every writer and poet who had written anything that was more than mildly liberal and was left-wing was somehow a horrible communist infiltrator from backed by the Soviet Union and by Joseph Stalin. That didn't last. So I have much more faith in the American public on that score. Yes, in the interim, scare works. People get scared. People get worried. And then they're dealing with a phenomenon that they don't know much about. I mean, before 9/11, how many Americans even thought about Islam or Muslims? I mean, they occasionally saw a woman with her head covered and knew she came from another religion. But I have run into people in that period in America who thought that the only women who cover their heads are Catholic nuns or Orthodox Jewish women. And you must remember, after 9/11, some ignorant people went and shot at Sikhs who come from a totally different religion just because they wore turbans and there were Orthodox Jews praying on flights who were taken off flights because it was assumed they are Muslim. So there's a lot of ignorance for people like Donald Trump, who's already quite ignorant about a lot of things in the world, to prey on other people's ignorance. But that's not going to last forever. At the end, what will have to happen is Muslim leaders will have to be far clearer on the subject of violent jihad than many have been. Yes, it is a part of Islamic history, just as a lot of violence has been part of, say, for example, Christian history. But in this century, we have to abjure it. So instead of defending everything that ever happened in Muslim history and saying, yeah, but that wasn't really wrong, we have to say, are there Muslims who are violent? Absolutely. Are they inspired by faith? Quite a lot of them. But very frankly, we need to build the faith in light of the 21st century. Those who want to be religious and pious, we welcome them. But piety and violence don't go together.
Well, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was such a pleasure. It always is a pleasure talking to you, Ian.
Thank you, Ambassador. And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, who's a senior fellow and director for South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute. He served as Pakistan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2011 and is widely credited with managing a difficult partnership during a critical phase in the global war on terrorism. We can take a brief station break and back look into the role that politics play in the radicalization of young Muslims opposed to religion that gets most of the attribution.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arun Kunnani, who is a professor of media culture and communication at New York University. He also teaches terrorism studies at the John Jay College, and he's the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain. And his latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arun Kunnani.
Thank you for having me.
And I guess the point that you're trying to make here is that there's a kind of mutual reinforcing going on of the militarized identity narrative on both sides, on the jihadists point to numerous speeches by Western leaders to support their claims of a war on Islam, and Western leaders legitimize war with talk of a generational struggle between Western values and Islamic extremism. Of course, I think, to be fair, you can't include Obama in that, who made a speech last night, but there are plenty of others out there, not the least of which is Donald Trump.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think I would be a little bit more critical of Obama than to totally exclude him from this process. So if you listen carefully to his speech last night, there was a kind of contradiction in it, which is that on the one hand, he was saying that we shouldn't discriminate against Muslims, which, of course, is correct. But also, he was implying that Muslims in the United States have a special responsibility to tackle radical extremism. And so, in a way, that does imply that we are singling out Muslims and holding them somehow collectively responsible as a community to kind of self-police, which, of course, is not what we ask of communities from which other kinds of violence has emerged. Whether it's, you know, we don't expect the Republican Party to collectively disown violence carried out by conservatives. So I think there is a problem, actually, with some of what Obama was saying yesterday.
Well, short of trying to enlist or mobilize the Islamic community into, I don't know exactly what the president's marching orders would be, but surely the only way to stop a young Muslim from becoming more radical is certainly that person's not going to listen to me or any Christians or any Jews. Presumably, the assumption would be that only another Muslim can dissuade a Muslim who's taking that path. Is that a reasonable supposition?
Not really. I don't think that is right. I mean, I think if there is someone who is involved in a criminal conspiracy to carry out an act of violence, and they are committed to that, then, you know, then that is a criminal investigation matter. If someone knows that's happening, whether they're Muslim, Jewish, Christian, atheist, whatever, that is a matter to inform the law enforcement agencies and have that investigated and have that person arrested before they can carry out that act of violence against their fellow civilians. If you're talking about a different situation in which you have a young person who seems to be expressing radical ideas, seems to be angry at Western foreign policy, anyone should, you know, engage that person in a debate if they feel that they disagree with that person's views. And in my experience, from meeting very many young Muslims who are angry about the actions of the US government or the British government or the French government, they are up for a debate with anyone on those issues because they feel passionately about them. I think the mistake we're making here is that we tend to think that there is this process of radicalization that is all about radical ideology turning someone into a terrorist, right? This is the kind of formula that we've been sold by terrorism experts since 9/11, and that's why nowadays we talk about this thing called radicalization that we never used to talk about when we used to talk about terrorism more than 10 or so years ago. And it assumes that that there is an extreme religious ideology that converts someone into a terrorist. Well, actually, the empirical evidence is that is not the case. We never needed to think about terrorism in this way before. So, you know, what we really want to be thinking about is the role not just of ideas, because after all, ideas are things that we all should be entitled to express, and we don't criminalize ideas. What we really should be thinking of is what is it that makes someone feel that violence is legitimate in a particular context, right? That feels that it's an appropriate response to news coming from the Middle East that shows civilians being killed, maybe by drone strikes carried out by our government, or the violence in Palestine being carried out by the Israeli occupation there. What is it that leads someone to think, well, it's okay for me to respond to this violence by carrying out violence against my fellow citizens? That's really the question, which is not about ideology. It's not ideology that does that so much as a kind of constant immersion in those images of violence online, and an immersion in a very simple narrative, which is that the West is at war with Islam, right? And so if you look at the individuals who get involved in this stuff, they all have signed up to that very simple kind of binary narrative. There's the West on the one hand, there's Islam on the other. These two things are at war with each other, and you have to choose sides. That's the basic belief that they have. And to the extent that you know, we have people like Trump now, you know, taking these measures that demonize all Muslims, or proposing these measures that demonize all Muslims, we are completely reinforcing that narrative that drives people to think that violence is acceptable.
But in terms of groups of people sitting around plotting a criminal conspiracy, of course that's against the law. But and in terms of wanting a broader debate and certainly not getting one, I mean, I'd be in jail now because by the standards of if you criticize U.S. foreign policy, because I spent almost every interview with people criticizing U.S. foreign policy, I wish that... You know, obviously, Bush-Cheney tried to deflect that, saying that with this war on terror that they construed the notion that they hate us for who we are, not for what we do. So there's a lot of denial, obviously, about the role of U.S. foreign policy in the history of colonialism in the Middle East. But how can you divorce all of this from the context of religion? I mean, the head of the Islamic State, their whole flag, their whole appeal is a religious one, as far as I can tell, as is the Wahhabis, who are also a powerful force in radicalizing Muslims, or at least moving the religion itself in a very conservative direction.
There's no doubt that the Wahhabi and Salafi networks around the world have promoted a very conservative interpretation of Islam, and that's been funded to a great degree by the Saudis, and that's something to, I think, that we need to take on and challenge. Whether that kind of spread of a conservative interpretation of Islam is what has led to terrorism, I think, is questionable. And whether we, yes, of course, religion is a part of this, in the sense that these people are carrying out acts of violence in the name of a religious identity, right? But I think we massively overemphasize the idea that religious ideology is this thing that can convert someone into a terrorist. Look at the young people who are traveling from Europe to join ISIS. They are not religiously conservative. In fact, many of them know nothing at all about religion. Have not spent any time immersing themselves in religion. There is the now well-known story of young Muslims traveling from Britain to Syria carrying copies of Islam for Dummies that they've ordered off the internet. Right? Mm-hmm. There we know about the story of leader of the Paris attacks just recently who drank whiskey and smoked cannabis, right? So these are not necessarily religiously conservative people, and the religious conservatism does not correlate very well with likelihood of being a terrorist. So something else is going on here, and what it is really about is identity. It's about a very simple binary identity narrative. So for these people, what Islam represents is not a religious ideology. It represents a radical rejection of the West. That's essentially the point, right? And it's a very simplistic way of looking at the world. It divides the world up into two warring camps, and that is the extent of its actual political content, which is next to nothing. But that is the kind of underlying framework that these people are adopting.
So when incidents like last Wednesday's attack in out here in San Bernardino, California, take place, and you get the news gets into its cycle of frenzy. Invariably, of course, local imams come forth with press conferences and often say Islam is a religion of peace. They're extremely defensive. Obviously, that's not cutting it with an increasingly suspicious American public who being inflamed by Islamophobes like Donald Trump and ignoramuses like Dr. Ben Carson. So what would you suggest? First of all, do you think that they should step up to the mic in the first place? And two, what would you suggest they say?
Well, I think it's incredibly difficult for them because they are, in a way, the rules of this game have been set up so that they cannot win. Because, of course, if they do not speak out, then, you know, then the wider society says, you know, why are these Muslims not condemning what their fellow Muslims have done in the name of Islam? If they do speak out, it simply reinforces the idea of shared responsibility, and it reinforces the idea that somehow this is to do with Islam, and that's why these people have to own the acts that these fellow Muslims have carried out. And so I think my advice to imams would be, in fact, do not speak out unless, you know, other religious leaders and other civic leaders are also going to speak out on that same platform and also own this act of violence, even though they're not Muslim, because, you know, we're in a cycle of violence, not just the violence carried out by jihadists, but the violence that our own government carries out. So we need to condemn, if we're going to condemn what happened in California without hypocrisy, an attack on civilians in the name of a political narrative, then we also have to condemn the killings of civilians by drone strikes. So if we're going to do both of those things, and as a society as a whole, not just Muslims, condemn that violence, then we can start to change the narrative, right? So if I was an imam, I would be saying to other faith leaders, other civic leaders, let us have a press conference now, condemn this violence and some other kinds of violence as well. And then I think we can start to imagine a discourse and a conversation that is not discriminatory and is not hypocritical.
Well, it's my understanding that in many ways, as distasteful as a lot of Muslims feel the Daesh, the Islamic State, is, in the Sunni world, they feel, a lot of Sunnis feel, that they're the only people standing up for them because they've been, you know, thanks to Bush and Cheney's intervention in Iraq, they've lost Iraq, they're being rolled back. There's a perception with Obama's deal with Iran that the U.S., if not the rest of the West, is moving more towards, you know, making a deal, if you will, with Shia Islam and leaving Sunni Islam out in the cold. So surely that's a component in it, isn't it? The geopolitics and how they're handled by the very same president who made the speech last night trying to calm everybody down and to put it in a context. He didn't put it in that context, I don't think.
He didn't. You're right. I think the reason for that is that there seems to be very little connection between what happened in California and ISIS itself. So the only connection seems to be one of inspiration rather than direction. And therefore, it may not be that relevant for this specific incident to think about the geopolitics of ISIS. But of course, you're right that the geopolitics are hugely significant. Part of the base that ISIS has been able to build up in Iraq and Syria comes from the fact that some Sunnis in Iraq do feel that they have lost out in the new Iraq and its political arrangements, and there are legitimate grievances that they have around their marginalization and their discrimination against them since the new regime post 2003. I would just say one thing, which is, when we talk about the Sunni world, the Sunni population of the world is the Iraqi and even Syrian Sunni population is a tiny minority of the global Sunni population. You have millions and millions of Sunni Muslims in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and Indonesia and Malaysia who really, I don't feel that the issue of Sunni representation in Iraq is at all relevant to their lives. So this is very specifically about one country, Iraq, that's given rise to ISIS and then the spread of ISIS into Syria. And when we talk about the fear of Iran, what we really mean is the Gulf elite's fear of Iran, there is evidence that ISIS has been supported at least by some elements in the Gulf and Saudi elites as a way of countering Iranian influence that channels through the Assad regime in Syria, who's a close ally of Iran. So to some extent, this is about a regional Cold War playing out between governments. It's not a Sunni-Shia war in the narrow sense of a sectarian war, because it's about governments and politics as much as it's about disagreements over theology. I think it's important to just be precise that it is about politics again, not so much religious sectarianism.
Well, indeed, and the countries that you mentioned that have been funding ISIS, of course, are America's allies in this coalition, and that gets you back to this strange sort of dichotomy within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia itself between the royals and the Wahhabis, surely. And nobody quite knows about the state of flux in that long-standing relationship.
It is high time that we reassess, at the very least, our relationship with the Saudis, because the Saudi regime is not the root cause of terrorism in a narrow sense, but they have sponsored the most reactionary interpretation of Islam in the region. They have supported ISIS. They have carried out a brutal series of military incursions into neighboring countries like Bahrain and Yemen to suppress movements of human rights. Of all the countries in the world to have a strategic alliance with, they are the most reactionary. And yet they are our second closest regional ally after Israel. A large part of solving some of these problems that we confront in the Middle East would be dealt with if we actually broke off that relationship with Saudi Arabia. Historically, we always had this idea that we justified that the importance of that relationship because of our dependence on oil from Saudi Arabia. But in fact, most of our oil now comes from Canada. So it's really it's high time that we look at changing that particular strand to this.
Well, Arun Kundnani, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Arun Kundnani, who is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He also teaches terrorism studies at the John Jay College and is the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain. And his latest book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the Justice Department's launch of a pattern and practice investigation into the Chicago Police Department. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Craig Futterman, a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and previously the director of public interest programs and lecturer in law at Stanford University. He's the founder of the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Project of the Mandel Legal Aid Clinic, and he specializes in civil rights lawsuits involving police brutality and racial discrimination in Chicago. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Futterman.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And more bad news is coming out of Chicago with another video that was released today of Officer George Hernandez shooting to death a 25-year-old Ronald Johnson, who was fleeing the police on October the 12th of 2014. The police found the shooting was reasonable, as they did earlier with the Laquan McDonald case. So do you expect anything more to come of this in terms of reigniting the protests, et cetera, that accompanied the last revelation of a tape?
Yeah, I mean, the reality in Chicago is that these problems aren't brand new, but these problems have been with us for quite some time. We've long had systemic problems here that the police department has allowed the minority number of abusive police officers to prey on the city's most vulnerable residents, and that's Black folks. We've seen police shootings in Chicago on average of one time a week for the last 30 years. 75% of the folks who've been shot are African American. And, you know, these videos are, and I have not seen the one that was just released. I understand that the video shows that the young man was shot in the back twice while he was running away. And so, yes, people have the right to be deeply disturbed and the right to seek change. And I've been quite proud of the way in which my particularly younger folks, both here in Chicago and around the nation, have responded and really made the whole nation and certainly the city of Chicago care and to take note of what's going on.
Well, of course, the other headline today is that the United States Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced a new investigation into the Chicago Police Department following the revelations of the video shooting of Laquan McDonald. And she mentioned the possibility of a patent and practice. She called it a patent and practice investigation. And if a patent of violations is found, the Justice Department will seek a court enforceable agreement with the Chicago Police Department. That's happened in other cities. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, he's apparently originally didn't want to have a federal probe, but now he's, I guess, been forced to go along with it and said that the city would completely cooperate. So what's his role in all this? Because in the interviews I've done recently following the Laquan McDonald release of the video, we talked a lot about Lorenzo Davis, who's something of a hero for not wanting to whitewash these investigations being conducted by the Independent Police Review Authority. I noticed that Rahm Emanuel has appointed a new superintendent, John Escalante, but he's also appointed a new head of the Independent Police Review Authority, Sharon Fairley. So what do you know about her? And given what Lorenzo Davis has revealed, that's going to be quite a job cleaning house in the very agency that's supposed to investigate the police, but it's been actually giving them a free pass.
Yeah. Well, I think starting with federal intervention, the pattern and practice investigation, I think that's huge news, and that's a potential game changer, just starting there. We've, as I said at the outset, these aren't new issues. These are long-standing problems, and we've had scandal after scandal, police scandal after scandal over the years in Chicago, from systematic torture back in the day to just a few years ago, groups of officers who engaged in patterns of targeting Latinos for a false arrest, robbing them, breaking into their homes. And with each scandal, our leaders, we've seen a pretty familiar script. Some heads roll, and so people are fired, just as people have been fired here today. And there's announcements usually of a commission that's going to study the problem and will launch a thorough investigation. But then folks turn their heads and onto other things, and no one to date in Chicago has had the political courage to actually address the underlying issues about why police abuse has gone on unchecked for so many years. So I think starting with federal intervention, that gives me real hope, because we've shown over the years a lack of will and a lack of capacity to address this ourselves. And so I really welcome the help of the federal government on this. And that goes to your second point also about figuring out what to do with this agency, which has indeed whitewashed complaints over the years, and an agency that has deep cultural issues where, as you just noted, there was a supervisor in the agency who, longtime police officer, I believe almost a 30-year veteran of the force, deep integrity, not someone who is anti-police in any way, who then, when having the courage and when investigating with the team police shootings, found six shootings in the last few years to be completely unjustified, and then was ordered to erase his findings so that they would never exist and change them. And when he refused, he was fired, and not just fired for refusing to delete those findings from the record, where, I mean, that tells you a lot about what the culture of the agency is. But then on the other hand, I want to say one other thing about heroes and sheroes who aren't really known. This whole case, the Laquan McDonald case, may never have come to anyone's attention if I didn't get a call from a confidential informant within law enforcement who had seen the video and who was so deeply troubled and was afraid that it would be buried as other videos and other evidence of police shootings and abuse had been buried. And if they hadn't come forward, I have to admit myself, when I read about this, we have, as I noted, we have on average one shooting a week in Chicago, and see the same stories again and again, my eyes would have glazed over just as everyone else's did, and we wouldn't be talking, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So it really took a lot of courage of even folks from within, when you have such a deep code of silence. That person put their life and their career on the line just by reaching out, and we wouldn't be there without heroes like that.
Well, you just sort of breezed by the possibility, Craig, that you yourself might be a bit of a hero here, in the sense that you said that you found a CI, confidential informant, within the law enforcement community who had seen this incriminating video of the shooting of Laquan McDonald, came to you. Now, what role did you play, and what role did the investigative journalist who did the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, play as well?
Yeah, so after I received the call, we began to investigate and investigated the case, went to the scene, and I worked together with another investigative journalist by the name of Jamie Calvin, and we interviewed witnesses, and we requested the autopsy, and right away that we saw that the facts, and when we talked with witnesses themselves, they told me everything that the confidential source said about what happened and what the video showed, and so everything was just corroborated. And so we immediately made public calls to the city to be honest, release the video so that we could have an honest conversation both about what happened and what needs to be done, not just in this case, but about what needs to be done to fix systemic issues in the police department. We filed then, and another hero who you mentioned, a journalist, independent journalist by the name of Brandon Smith, files what's called a Freedom of Information Act request, seeking the release of the video. And we fight that, myself and another lawyer, Matt Topic, pro bono. He gave his time as well, and we fought this in court, and the city and the administration fought it to the very end until a judge ruled that there was absolutely no justification for keeping this information from the public. And that's what I think. I mean, just imagine how, so this is Chicago, just imagine how this whole situation would have been different if right from the beginning that the police department and administration were honest with people, if within 24 or 48 hours released the video, if it had credible machinery for addressing police abuse from the beginning. We wouldn't be having this kind of a conversation, and there wouldn't be the same kind of anger and outrage. There would be anger and outrage because, I mean, anyone who's seen that video and anyone who's looked at it can't help be shocked. be shocked. I mean, it's an execution. There's no way to make it any nicer than that. It's an execution of a 17-year-old kid. That doesn't happen every day. But sadly, what does happen, or happens on an all too frequent basis in Chicago, is what exactly happened after the shooting, which is a cover up and circling the wagons and lying and not being honest to folks. And that honestly is, I think, what has angered people in Chicago even more than the horrible execution itself, the cover up of it.
So in terms of the culture that you mentioned of the Chicago Police Department, which is the second largest police force in the nation, how far back do you think it goes? And how far back has this been routine, the killing of people? Because, for example, there have been reports that the Chicago Police Department also, for decades, were torturing people. And even had secret locations that were off the books, that, you know, without habeas corpus, people were getting hauled off into some, you know, like almost like the CIA black sites that came out of the Cheney torture regime, you know.
The issues of police abuse and even police torture go back quite a ways in this city, long history. So it's not this administration. Mayor Emanuel, he did not create the code of silence. He did not come in. He did not create racism or sexism on the police force. Those things existed before he got there, but he inherited them. And then as a leader, you have a responsibility to address them. And the first step in addressing those things is acknowledging them, acknowledging that the code of silence exists and that it's a problem, acknowledging that there are real issues of conscious and unconscious racism on the force that has caused grievous harms to entire communities here. And up to this point, he had fallen far short in remedying it. He made some positive steps toward transparency when about a year ago, and with us as a result of another piece of litigation, opened police misconduct records to the public in ways that we've never seen before, in ways that other states should follow. We established a legal principle here in Chicago or in Illinois that police misconduct records belong to the public, and we've just created a database along with Jamie Calvin Invisible Institute that allows folks to look at information about each and every complaint within the last 5 years. But that's only a piece of it, and the problem is that the culture that goes way back is a code of silence that's deeper than some steps, and even important steps toward transparency, because at the same time that we took that step forward, the Laquan McDonald case shows you that we still have the same usual culture, which is when an incident like this happens, we circle the wagons, we hide, we cover up, witnesses were intimidated, evidence was destroyed, and lies were told, and lies continued to be told for as much as a year that went all the way up the chain of command. I mean, lieutenants and commanders signed off on those lies. Police department put out official statements and press release that repeated those lies, and none of that was corrected until a judge ordered the release of the truth. And I'm glad to see, because this is a real opportunity for the mayor now, and I'm glad to see that he has begun to acknowledge some of those realities. And this is a political test for him and his legacy. Will he go down as someone who helps to reform the Chicago Police Department in ways that it's resisted in its entire history, or will he go down as a part of the problem? So this is a real test of leadership.
Well, it was a pretty much a prevailing opinion amongst people that I talked to, and admittedly, most of them were pretty critical of the police department, that Mayor Emanuel, the former superintendent who was just fired, was basically a sacrificial lamb. And he came out of the Bratton Reform School, didn't he?
Yes, yeah. He worked first in NYPD, and then also he was the chief of police in Newark, New Jersey.
Right. So why did he fail? Just as setting aside whether or not he was Mayor Emanuel's sacrificial lamb, why did he fail?
Well, in the same ways that I spoke of the ways the mayor has fallen short. The superintendent did some positive things, and I don't want to discount some of the things and some of the progress that he made, but in terms of police accountability, in terms of the code of silence, in terms of addressing racism in the police department, he's fallen far short. He continued practices that included the stop and frisk practices of that have focused on Black and brown kids in Chicago, where we have stopped per capita far more kids of color and at far greater disparate rates than stop and frisk in New York at the height of stop and frisk. And so he's also responsible for both those practices, those policies, and his failures to address police accountability in Chicago. And that's also saying that he also did some good things as well. And it's not all bad, but in terms of accountability, that's something that he's fallen far short on.
Well, just in closing, Craig Fadiman, if it's taken decades to create this culture of unaccountability and the code of silence in the Chicago police force, presumably it's going to take at least a decade to clean it up and to change the culture, if not more.
I disagree. Okay. I mean, the good news is that there are really straightforward ways to address this and fix this. And the other good news is that when I look at not just the data but the reality, and I know these officers, that the vast majority of police officers in Chicago aren't out there abusing people, aren't out there killing people, and aren't out there violating people's rights on a daily basis. What we have in Chicago, though, isn't a problem of a few bad apples, but that it's that a smaller percent, which is still a lot of officers, but a small percent, relatively small percent, is responsible for a lion's share of abuse. But the issue in Chicago is that we have allowed that small percent to abuse the most vulnerable among us with absolute impunity. But there are straightforward fixes. It starts with being honest with people, transparency, honesty. If you want to establish trust, you want to fix what's wrong, it starts with being honest with people. And number two, even with two patterns of abuse, so if the issue is that there are a relatively small percentage that are causing all our problems, they're actually really easy to identify. It's not a matter of technology. It's not a matter of not knowing who they are. It's a matter of having the political will to actually look at those patterns when we're investigating and disciplining misconduct. We can get rid of these folks, or get rid of the vast majority of these folks. And finally, the code of silence, it starts with leadership. I mean, so back to the good news is that there are a lot of officers who hate police abuse as much as the most vocal outside critic, because those officers like Van Dyke give them all a bad name. They make people hostile toward them. They make their jobs near impossible, and they steal their honor. So I think that if we address the code of silence head on, starting with leadership, meaning that we're not going to tolerate it, you participate in it, you'll be fired. But just as importantly, that we'll protect the heroes, the people like Lorenzo Davis on the inside, like the person who had the courage to come forward to speak with me confidentially, so that they don't have to operate in secret, such that they will be seen as true heroes. They won't be retaliated against. They'll be protected. And those who participate in the code of silence and who lie will be fired. I think they're straightforward fixes. It doesn't take a decade. We can do this.
Well, Craig Fadiman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Craig Fadiman, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, and previously was the director of the Public Interest Program and lecturer in law at Stanford Law School. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.